This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Good food is all about flavor and different flavor combinations. Some things just go together. Others don't. Smart cooks know that, and that's what sets their meals apart from the crowd. It's what makes certain restaurants so popular. But in times like these, you may not be dining out quite as often as you used to. You may be confronting food at home. What if you could incorporate this knowledge of what foods work together, what ingredients complement and bring out the best in each other in your own cooking? Well, you can, and that's what we'll spend the hour on. Johnson & Wales chef on assignment Peter Reinhardt is back, and this time he's invited Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg to join us. They're a couple both on and off the page, and they've written many pages about food pairings and put them in their latest book, The Flavor Bible, The Essential Guide to Culinary Creativity, based on the wisdom of America's most imaginative chefs. They are also the authors of What to Drink with What You Eat, and they join us from studios at Carnegie Hall in New York, which puts a new spin on the answer to the age-old question, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Learn to cook. Well, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
And you're very welcome. And Peter Reinhardt is in our studio, of course, here in Charlotte. Welcome to you. Welcome back to you.
Well, great to be back. I'm excited about today. I expect to learn a whole lot from Karen and Andrew because they have written the definitive book on the subject.
I got to tell you, I've been carrying around the Flavor Bible in my briefcase for about a month now.
It's heavy.
It must
be getting some real muscles there.
Well, I'm now a god. Yeah.
An Adonis.
He's looking kind of buff. Yeah.
Because it is heavy. Valentine's Day.
And I was expecting it to be recipes and it is not. It is literally a list of every single known food in the world and whether it goes how it goes together and the order in which it would go together and the order in which you would use it in recipes. It is fascinating. Where did you get the idea to do it this way?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's long car trips when you kind of think about everything and nothing at the same time. And during one of those legendary trips, Andrew and I were talking with each other, and we were kind of musing on the fact, now, what would the ultimate cookbook look like? Would it be, thousands of pages long with recipes for everything under the sun? Well, no. I mean, who wants to carry around a book like that? What it would be a guide to anything you could ever imagine cooking in the kitchen, from apples to zucchini. And let me know the best herbs, spices, and other seasonings that will best enhance the flavor of that particular ingredient. And so, essentially, we started collecting this information. Through our previous books, we've interviewed some of the best chefs across the country and started asking them, what's the secret to making X taste delicious? And combined it into a book.
I have to ask, this really has nothing to do with our conversation, but I have to ask before I forget to ask, there are some incredible photographs scattered throughout this book of beautiful, beautifully prepared food. And there's no indication on the page of what it is. do the pictures match up with some of the ingredients? I mean, could I duplicate these somehow if I wanted to?
Absolutely. A lot of times it's very straightforward where you'll see a pasta shot, or if you look up shrimp, you'll see shrimp. And you'll see like little canals of some ingredient. You'll look at the shrimp category, and you'll see the avocado goes with shrimp. And you'll see things that look like bacon. Well, it is bacon, and bacon is also listed with shrimp. So we really tried to find dishes that really were evocative of all the ingredients that you would find in that section. Even cauliflower, you'll find pine nuts and raisins and vinegar. So we tried to sort of bring the page, the list to life that way with the photographs.
Well, you know, Karen mentioned a few minutes ago, she was talking about apples, and immediately I thought, you know, one of the great flavor combinations in my taste memory Hall of Fame is apples and cheddar cheese. And you think about certain things in tandem like that, and how eating one seems to enhance the other. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, why that is? Why does that happen in our mouths that way?
You know, isn't it interesting how, you know, and I would imagine you could probably go back to that first experience of apples and cheddar, and maybe, you know, you kind of wrinkled your nose when someone melted a slice of cheese on your apple pie, and then you taste it, and it's like, wow, that really works. You know, the sweetness and the tartness of the apples playing against the richness of the cheese and that slight fattiness, it kind of, you know, enhances the overall experience. And then you think, okay, well, if it works, if a slice of cheese melted on a piece of pie works, or when I tasted it for the first time back in the 1960s or the 1970s, how else can I play with that combination of apples and cheese? I can cut up apples. I can dip it into a cheese fondue. Mm-hmm. Bingo. You know, it's a completely different format. It's a completely different presentation, but that classic flavor pairing of apples and cheese is still there. Mm-hmm. And then you can keep, you know, taking it to the next iteration. Now we're in a generation where a lot of young cooks are and chefs are experimenting as molecular gastronomists, so-called, or avant-garde chefs, where they're pushing things in a whole new direction. And it would not surprise me in the least to show up at a restaurant one day and see it turned into an apple sorbet with a powdered cheese sprinkled along the plate, you know, something really outrageous. And again, you put it in your mouth, and what happens is flavors of apples and cheese come together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes sense, even if the presentation itself is something completely unlike anything you've ever seen.
Well, maybe it would be good, especially for a lot of our listeners who like food but don't necessarily have the gastronomy background, to talk a little bit about how we experience these tastes and flavors. I mean, what's going on in our mouth, our taste receptors? Where do we experience these flavors?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of people, you know, there have been countless, you know, hundreds of thousands of cookbooks written over, you know, since the beginning of time. And it's interesting how little attention we've really paid to the subject of flavor. It's kind of hard to believe that people still use the terms flavor and taste interchangeably, mm-hmm. when in fact they're such very different things. Mm. And so when we opened up the Flavor Bible, we realized that that ultimate cookbook that we'd envisioned on that long road trip when we started thinking about it would really explain what is flavor all about and what are its components so that you can more proactively manage all of those elements of flavor when you're in the kitchen. And so we start out with chapter one with an equation that is flavor equals taste plus mouthfeel plus aroma, plus what we call the X factor. And for, you know, an equation, you really have to look at each element of that. But what it says is that flavor does not equal taste. Flavor, taste is just one small component, in fact, of flavor. And by taste, what we're talking about is really those four basic tastes that people are familiar with that you can taste on your taste bud. And, of course, we could get into a discussion of the fifth taste, umami, yeah. which is that savory mouth-filling quality that you'll get from things like
Parmesan cheese.
Yeah, exactly. So the four main ones are what? Salty?
Sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. Okay. And usually people say sweet first. You know, we're kind of conditioned culturally to think of sweetness. You know, it's a treat. It's that flavor that satiates our palates at the end of a meal. You know, that's why we end with dessert instead of beginning with dessert, because sweetness satiates. And if you start out with a sweet appetizer, forget it. No, your guests aren't going to have any appetite for the entree.
Well, for those of us who'd like to, you know, have dessert first because life is short, maybe that would be smart. maybe we would lose weight at the same time and consider ourselves. Let's get back to that flavor equation, because people might be puzzled by this. If flavor doesn't equal taste, but taste is part of the equation, what is taste? It's those four things that we feel in various parts of our mouth, the salty, sweet, sour, bitter. Is that
right.
what that is?
And then umami. And there are other flavors, you know, as we learn more, as scientists study the taste more, which I think they haven't, you know, it's so funny. I mean, I think people have studied every aspect of our visual senses and our auditory senses and our other senses, but I think taste has gone relatively unstudied. And I think there hasn't been a lot of serious academic attention that's been paid to it vis-a-vis our other senses.
Well, they say that those who lose the sense of smell because of an accident of some sort also lose a big amount of their taste. But aroma, which is associated with smell, is one of the ingredients in the equation, aside from taste. How important
Absolutely.
Is aroma?
Well, you know,
some chefs would say that aroma is 80% of the equation of taste.
Wow.
And I think that is a really important thing to realize. And again, you know, if you sort of are trying to figure out this equation, whether it's true or not, well, think about how your taste buds are affected during cold and flu season. Mm-hmm. You know, the minute you lose your aroma senses because of that cold, all of a sudden food becomes much duller.
And so
a lot of chefs really put a lot of focus on the aroma. And even the cutting-edge chef, someone like Grant Atchus of Alinea, incorporates a smoking leaf into one of his dishes. So when it comes to the dining room, I think it's a squab dish, and he lights it like a local maple leaf, and so you get that little bit of whiff of smoke, and that sort of gets your aromas going. It sort of gets you thinking about grilled meat, And there you go. So that's he literally incorporates that into the dish.
I know that one of the great sort of experiment tests that we do for students in teaching them about this difference between taste and flavor is to have them taste something and hold their nose when they taste it and identify the taste sensations. Like, for instance, a lemonade, you know, you can taste the sour and you can taste the sweet, but you don't taste lemon. And then you open, if you let go of your nose and you drink that same lemonade, all of a sudden, it's almost like it goes into three dimensions instead of two dimensions.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, it's sort of like those magic eye pictures that were very popular in the 90s, where you can see a whole different something happens, something, you know, a whole different dimension comes to light.
And there's this mouthfeel part of the equation that you talk about, and I guess that's why we tend to overeat potato chips, because we just like the crunch. they have no nutritional value. They're not good for us. They're full of salt and they're fattening. But we like the crunch. And I was reading through your book yesterday, and one of the chefs that you talk about, when he talked about preparing a salad, he said, we always make sure that there's something crunchy in the salad because that adds to the experience of eating the salad. Does that then add to the flavor of the salad?
Oh, absolutely. Because if you think about a salad, you know, salad grains are essentially bitter. And so you can really incorporate a whole nother flavor and texture when you're doing a crouton. And a lot of chefs play with their idea of crunch. Some will add something light like fried shallots, or you might want to do a toasted nut like a walnut, which is going to add a little bit of a bitter component, or something sweet and rich like a pinoli. So you can really play with one more flavor and add a lot of texture to something, because really when you think about a salad, it's just soft greens, you know, in this lovely pile, and then you put some cheese on there that's soft too. So you really do want to think about the crunch, and whether it's a sweet cornbread crouton or a nut, there's a lot of ways to go to make that salad a lot more exciting.
And then we get to the X factor, yeah. And I'm wondering what that is, but is part of the X factor perhaps the way the food looks on the plate? If it looks really good, is it going to taste better to us psychologically?
Sure. I mean, the X factor really refers to everything else, because flavor is so complex. And as we said, you know, we're learning more about it every single day. And I think there's a lot of other elements of flavor that, you know, we haven't even articulated yet. And I mean, we collectively, not just Andrew and myself, but, you know, all of us as a food community, we're still really, you know, pulling back the layers of what flavor is and what food is. But because we're human beings, we taste differently than animals. We have the experience of memory. We have the experience of discernment. So we bring, you know, emotions, memories, you know, mental constructs to our experience of flavor. And all of these come to play, so that if I set before you what I think is the most perfect strawberry shortcake, and there's an identical one in front of me and an identical one in front of you, and you know, it turns out that, boy, strawberries were my favorite fruit growing up, and I'm going to have this wonderful emotional connotation when I see that strawberry shortcake. On the other hand, if you happen to be allergic to strawberries, you're going to, you know, push it as far away from you as you can get it.
Yeah.
So we have to take all those things into
account.
That
is really an X factor, then. Yeah. And that reminds me, as you were describing that scene in Ratatouille where the critic eats the ratatouille and is transported back to childhood and these amazing, you know, childhood memories. And that's a powerful...
Oh, Peter. Yes. I'm so happy you mentioned that scene, because I think that is the single greatest... I mean, forget Babette's Feast, forget Tempopo. That is the single greatest, most moving scene I've ever seen in any food-related film.
Well, evidently one of our callers, who is already on the line, agrees with you, and we'll take her call right after we come back from the break. Dorinda's calling from Baltimore. So hang on, Dorinda. We'll get to you. Our guests are Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, food writers and James Beard Award-winning co-authors of The Flavor Bible and What to Drink with What You Eat, among other things. And Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University, is also with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is funded in part today by the Charlotte Guitar Society, presenting a Valentine's Day concert with classical guitarist Patrick Louis this Saturday, 7:30, Tate Hall at CPCC. Tickets available at CPCC at 704-330-6534. We're stuck here in the middle of the worst economy since the Great Depression. And yet on Wednesday, I think it's safe to say that Charlotte's biggest store will open right off of I-85 and University City Boulevard, IKEA. football fields, this store is. It's the biggest big box you'll ever see. And they're opening in the worst economy. So we're going to take a look at retailing and how they're doing, who's doing well, who is not doing so well, and what some of them are doing to survive. Monday at 9.
The Friday News Roundup. Congress reaches a deal on a stimulus package. President Obama holds his first primetime news conference. And Treasury Secretary Geithner defends the slow rollout of the bank rescue plan. The Diane Rehm Show, Friday.
The News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show coming up from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks. Here on 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
Hey, good looking, what you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
Howdy.
Hey, sweet baby.
Oh, gosh. Hank Williams joins us on the program here at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Peter Reinhardt in our studio and at the Carnegie Hall Studios, Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, food writers. Do you still write for The Washington Post, by the way? Just curious.
Yeah, we've been writing the weekly wine column for The Washington Post since March of 2007. And when the Flavor Bible came out in September, it was just we couldn't keep up because we were out on book tour. So we had scaled back at that point.
Okay. Well, the Flavor Bible is truly a Bible of flavor. It's exactly what it says. And we're going to be talking about that and about food pairings as we go through the hour. And before we went to the break, we were talking, Peter brought up, I think, Ratatouille, the movie. And Dorinda had already gotten on the line from Baltimore to talk about something with regard to Ratatouille. So, Dorinda, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah, good.
Go ahead.
That's one of my favorite movies, Ratatouille, even though there are rats in the kitchen. And especially that part about when the critic got his favorite food and how he was like, whoa, and took it back to his childhood. It was just amazing that I wanted that movie, and I got it for my birthday in September 9/11. I was so excited, and right now I loan that movie out to someone. And when I gave it to the person, he said, I cannot imagine rats in the kitchen. I said, yes, but it's the experience, the whole, they mix the ingredient, just one rat.
Yes, rats in the kitchen is that X factor, I think we were
But that would be the negative X factor.
Yeah, maybe you could expand a little bit on that whole idea of taste memory, because that is a very powerful concept that James Beard and other food writers have discussed.
Yeah, and I think it's really at the heart of the artistry that is culinary artistry, that a moment like that is so transcendent. And, of course, we've experienced it looking at a great masterwork in an art museum, a fabulous painting on the wall that transports us somewhere else, or going to a symphony that moves us on another level. And I think, it's funny. I think that those food experiences that have really transported us to that level had not been explored, certainly not on film to that extent before Ratatouille, and certainly not in such a popular film. But we've all had those moments
about
tasting
Babette's
something
Feast?
That take us back.
What about Babette's Feast or Chocolat?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's got their own particular favorite.
Well, that is what makes it an X
really
factor.
Talks about.
Okay. Dorinda, thank you for your call. Let's go back and talk a little bit very quickly about sweet, salty, sour, bitter, because we taste these, I understand at least, on different parts of our palate. So when we're combining these flavors, should you combine them all in the same dish, or should you combine them, should you serve them in different courses? How should you work with these different flavors?
Well, I think you can play with it a lot of different ways, and certainly we were talking about a salad where that's a great way to incorporate something sweet, salty, bitter, sour. I mean, you have bitter greens, you might have a sweet crouton, acidic sour from the vinaigrette. But also if you wanted to play with something even more fun, you could do something like a steak, where if you have a steak and you're going to get you have a nice seared steak with nice salt on it, well, you can get a little bit of the bitter from the red wine. Or, again, so you can play with wine pairings, and you can play with sweet and bitter that way. And also, when you think about bitter, think about different ways to do bitter. So I think we say radicchio or something like that. It's easy to understand bitter. But think about bitter chocolate. And we did a tasting yesterday of some fresh ricotta, and we put some very dark, bitter chocolate on there. And that was the way to bring in the bitter against the sweetened ricotta. So you can really play with sweet, salty, and bitter in a lot of different ways in a lot of different dishes, whether it's on the plate or in the glass.
Well, a lot of people think of bitter when it stands alone as something unpleasant. Why is it that bitter actually can work to enhance the joy and, you know, an experience of taste?
You know, it's all about the balance and flavor. I think when you're eating something that's incredibly rich, Andrew made me this wonderful soup yesterday that was, you know, had some grains in it, lentils, and there was a richness to it that was almost too much. You know, we had it for lunch, and lunch, I think I like to have salads. I like to have things that are a little lighter. What he did was brilliant. He took some greens, and he threw a handful of greens into the soup before he served it to me. So they still had that freshness to them. They weren't, you know, cooked to death, but they were wilted in the soup, and that bitterness added a bit of lightness to it. So the soup was a much lighter experience than it would have been otherwise because of those bitter greens.
So they're kind of like counterpoints, and they and instead of kind of standing out, they balance each other out.
Exactly. I don't know that you really want to make bitter the star of the plate. I think you want to use it as an accent.
If you'd like to join our conversation, as Dorinda already has, without even knowing the phone number, somehow she got through. Here are our phone numbers, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can join us on our blog at wfae.org/charlotteblogs. I didn't know till I read your book yesterday, I never thought about this, I guess, that for instance, saltiness encourages thirst. That's why they put salted peanuts and pretzels and things on bars, so you'll drink more. And sourness quenches your thirst. Mm. Is that why lemonade is served in the summertime? Because people are thirsty, and as soon as you taste that sourness, you're sated? Why would that be?
You've got it. No, that's exactly. And, you know, imagine iced tea. What's the number one accompaniment to iced
lemon.
Tea? A slice of lemon. Exactly.
To me,
so it's the same principle.
Iced tea without lemon is not worth drinking.
I'm with you.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely.
And it seems like lemon is one of those wonderful ingredients that enhances so many foods. I mean, I can't eat, for instance, a lox and bagel sandwich without squeezing some lemon on it. It seems like it just takes it to another level. Again, what is it about this the acid and the sour that causes the flavors to explode on your palate?
And, you know, it's so interesting because when we did our book that was actually a precursor to the Flavor Bible back in 1996, a book called Culinary Artistry, we had interviewed some of the country's leading chefs, and as sort of a fun exercise just to see what they would say, Andrew and I banished them to a desert island for the rest of their lives and said, okay, we're going to give you 10 ingredients you can take with you. What 10 and only those 10 would you take with you to cook with for the rest of your life? Mm. And the number one ingredient that chefs brought along with them at that point in time was salt. And it sort of surprised us, but then we realized, well, salt is the number one flavor enhancer. So whatever else they're bringing along or whatever else they might happen to find on that deserted island, it's going to taste better if they've got salt available. And also in the next right behind it was some form of acid. So whether it was lemons or limes or what have you, that is the number two flavor enhancer for savory food. And it also works for a number of sweet dishes, having some form of acid in the form of, and citrus, I think, it has that particular ability to brighten a dish, to add a little bit of sparkle. And that is a number of leading chefs that we've interviewed. When you get them to tell you what some of their secrets are, they'll have their favorite form of acids, whether it's a citrus or vinegar or what have you.
You keep bringing up savory foods, and you mentioned umami, which is the fifth basic flavor, according to your Bible, at least it is. Explain the concept of savory. I think somebody said Parmesan cheese would be a good example of that. Why is that different than cheddar cheese or any other flavor that you might taste? What makes it savory?
Well, going back to your question of umami, you know, it's interesting that a fifth flavor has evolved. You know, we all know sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. So to be able to try to put in a category on another sensory experience, I think that we will continue to see other flavors being isolated. Hmm. You know, some people will use the term pungency to describe a particular ingredient that, you know, whether it's wasabi or, you know, chili peppers, you know, to express that, aside from the heat, you know, sort of the other flavors involved. So I think we're going to continue to make more distinctions, and I do hope people will put more work into that. You know, the savory quality, we like to differentiate between sweet and savory. Savory being anything you sort of eat before dessert, typically, although savory foods can certainly have sweet elements to them. And then sweetness, you know, we certainly traditionally have it for dessert, but there are, you know, times, one of my favorite salads in New York that I pick up around the corner when I want to grab something fast actually has dried cherries in it, and it adds that bit of texture, but it also adds a note of sweetness. So again, if you're looking to satiate yourself a little bit earlier and maybe cut down on what you're eating, even adding just those little notes of dried cherries to a salad can make it that much more satisfying.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we know that in, for instance, Asian cuisine, especially Chinese cuisine, we see a lot of this interplay of sweet and sour and sweet and spicy and sweet and, you know, or, you know, salt and spice. And so it's clear that these, I guess when we're putting flavors together, the idea of the symbiotic relationship between these is really important, that one actually enhances the other. They're not designed to kind of stand alone in our palate.
I would agree. And then also not overpower. That's the thing, you know, you want to really keep in mind too when you're balancing your flavors.
Are there any tips that you can give people in terms of how to achieve that kind of balance?
I think when we found, we're interviewing chefs again, we've been talking a lot about citrus and salt and things, and chefs, when they're doing their seasonings, a lot of times will add that little bit of salt and citrus at the end. And one chef literally said they have a citrus element right next to the salt when they're seasoning dishes. So again, you know, you would do that classic thing when you taste the dish right before you serve it, you know, sort of just run the numbers. Is it bright enough? Is it sharp enough? Or is it a little flat? And what can I do to fix that? And, you know, as a former professional chef, right next to my stove, I have probably 8 different vinegars, 5 different oils, and 3 or 4 different salts. And I always have a lemon and an orange and a lime on hand. So you just want to think about what can I do just to pop that flavor just a little bit
more. I was going to ask you, there you can go to the store and you can buy, you know, Morton salt. You can buy kosher salt. You can buy sea salt. Is there really a difference in the flavor of these salts? Certainly there's a difference in the size of the granule, but is there a difference in the flavor?
Night and day, it is a gigantic difference. And I think something that's very fun to do, and we used to do this when we were teaching a lot more, was we would do a salt tasting. And if you just take a minute at home and, you know, grab that table salt and buy some fleur de sel and some kosher salt. And now there's also smoked sea salts. There's vanilla salt. But if just sort of sticking to the, like, what you'd use at your table, yes, there is a gigantic difference. And fleur de sel, very light. You use that at the end, right before you serve a dish. And if you put it in too early, you would be overpowered. So you wouldn't, like, if you're making a soup or searing a steak or something, you would lose the salt element because it's too delicate. And that's when you would use your kosher salt. And that would work beautifully. So, yeah, salts have different weights, just like wine, or if you're doing a water tasting, you'll find a wide variety of flavor variations.
You have a chart very early in your book, the Flavor Bible, which lays out wines and foods from light to medium to heavy. I take it that was simply there as a guide to help us categorize food in those ways, but can we also use it as a way of preparing foods and ordering foods, not in terms of ordering from a waiter, but in terms of the order we are served or eat them in, and with foods as well as wine?
You know, it's so interesting because when we wrote our book, What to Drink with What You Eat, Andrew had earlier earned a sommelier certificate, and right before the book came out, I did as well. And it was our study of wine that taught us so much about food. and they gave us some interesting concepts to work with. And I do think you are absolutely right, Mike, that you can use that chart as a guideline to what the weights of different foods are. And that's not something that is that is an element of every cookbook, and I think maybe it should be, just really giving people who cook an ability to think about what is the weight of a particular ingredient and how can you not overpower it or pair it with an ingredient that doesn't stand up to it. And certainly those principles are very useful in food. I think it used to be you would pair by color, you know, white wine with fish, red wine with meat as a general rule. But what is even more useful when pairing wine is to really think about the weight of the dish and the weight of the wine. You don't want to pair a very heavy dish with a light wine because it's out of balance. Likewise, you can apply some of those principles when you're cooking as well.
Yeah, this is really interesting. You know, what ingredient I'm fascinated with, and I wonder if you can speak a little bit about it, because I think it's one of the most mysterious and exotic of all ingredients, and that's the truffle, you know, the black and the white truffle, which almost seems to defy being nailed down to any one particular flavor or taste. What is it about that that makes it so amazing and unique?
Well, you know, I think that the first thing that comes to mind with truffle, you know, I can enjoy it even if I'm not shelling out $50 to put it on, you know, it's usually a supplemental charge at a restaurant to have it shaved over my pasta. Even if the people at the next table are getting it done, I'm getting, you know, at least $5 worth
of
pleasure
just
from smelling it, because that smell is so amazing. But I think that that's where aroma comes in, as just being such a vital part of flavor.
So it's kind of
just, well, there's a real earthiness to a truffle that you can't get in any other mushroom, really. You know, there's something about the fact that it's underground, you know, versus something like a shiitake, which grows above, which, you know, is meaty, but it's not earthy and meaty. And I think that's what's so fun about a truffle. Like, and you could use it so many different ways, whether it's shaved on top of the pasta the last second, or if you cut it thin and put it, this is a classic dish of putting it under the skin of a roast chicken and then roasting your chicken. It just infuses the chicken with, again, the aroma that Karen was mentioning, but a certain earthiness that you can't get from anything else. And that's why I think it's such an incredible ingredient to work with.
Well, as long as we're talking about smell, among other things, let's take a call from Bob in Lenore, because he has a comment to make about that. Bob, go ahead. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
My comment is that since I lost my sense of smell some 25 years ago in a due to a head injury, and I'm very cognizant of flavors and foods and eat a wide range of things, I'd like to say that the idea that I have lost my sense of taste as well is exaggerated.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
In other words,
Absolutely.
I have a sense of taste, and I tend to eat more spicy foods, and I put more spices on my foods when I'm eating them, but I enjoy my wines and foods tremendously, just as most people do, and it's not nearly as serious as you might say. I think the thing about losing your sense of smell that is so serious is that it's the sense that's most connected with memory, and I regret losing my sense of smell, particularly for that reason, but not for eating reasons. And one other comment that one of your guests made, that animals may not have the same sense of taste and all that we have. You know, I think it's very, very speciesist to even make such a comment, because how could we ever know what they experience?
I don't know. You ever watch a dog eat?
It seems to me that a dog with a sense of smell that's 1,000 times more powerful than ours.
Yeah.
Very likely could have a sense of taste that's at least equal to ours.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't, if it was the comment that I'd made earlier, I think what I was, the point that I was looking to make was the distinction that we as human beings have from animals, not in terms of the sense of taste, but in terms of the X factor, that we have certain experiences that animals do not have, that they're not able to bring to that experience of flavor.
But I think that I've also seen some studies done where they identify that certain animals, we'll say dogs and cats, don't have as many taste buds as we do, but their sense of smell is much stronger. So the way they experience flavor may be very different from ours, but they're still experiencing flavor in some form or another.
Bob, thank you for your call. We have to take a break. Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, authors of The Flavor Bible, are with us from Carnegie Hall, and Peter Reinhardt's in our studio. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Daniel Stowe Botanical Gardens Orchid Spectacular through February 15th. Orchid-themed classes are also offered, such as producing award-winning orchids and growing orchids in the home. Details at dsbg.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock, it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, the National Hour first, the International Hour second at 11. Congress reaches a deal on the stimulus package. President Obama holds his first primetime press conference. And the Treasury Secretary defends the slow rollout of a bank rescue plan. In the first hour with Juan Williams from NPR and Fox News, David Korn, the Washington Bureau Chief of what, I wonder, and Matthew Continetti, Associate Editor of the Weekly Standard, all on the panel at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, now would be the time. We're talking about food pairings and flavors and how to bring out the best in all the food that you eat or cook. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE.
WFAE invites you to treat yourself and someone special to a night on the town this Valentine's season. Enter now to win a voucher for fine dining supplied by Carpe Diem Restaurant in Charlotte, two movie passes, and a little extra for a guest or a babysitter. One lucky winner will be drawn from entries received by midnight, February 13th. To enter, go to WFAE.org/town.
Oh, I can cook, too, on top of the rest. My seafood's the best in the town. Yes, I can cook, too. My fish can't be beaten. My sugar's the sweetest around. I'm a man's ideal of a perfect meal right down to the demi-tail. I'm a pot of joy for a hungry boy, baby. I'm cooking with gas, so I'm a gumdrop, a sweet lollipop, a brook trout right out of the brook. And what's more, baby, I can cook.
Another example of the X Factor. Nancy Walker, thank you for being with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Peter Reinhardt's with us in our studio. Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg join us from New York, the authors of The Flavor Bible and What to Drink with What You Eat. Among other things, they are James Beard Award-winning authors. Before, I know you want to go into Valentine's Day, Peter, but before we do that, I think it was you, Andrew, who mentioned that you used a certain ingredient. You would use it later. Like, I think it was a salt that you would use later because it was so delicate. If you used it early in cooking the meal, it would disappear. And in the book, you suggest that anise, it's anise, isn't it, be used early in the cooking process, whereas balsamic vinegar should be used toward the end. That's something I never considered, so maybe other people haven't either. Talk about the order in which you use ingredients and why that's important.
Sure. I think every ingredient sort of has its lifespan within the cooking technique. And let's say something like if you're making a soup, you would throw in a bay leaf at the very beginning because a bay leaf is going to take a good, you know, couple hours to sort of come out of its shell and experience its flavors and infuse the dish. But if, let's say, we wanted to put in some fresh herbs like parsley, well, parsley would lose its flavor within a few minutes of the cooking process. So you're not going to start with the parsley. You're going to start with a dried herb. And you're going to finish with a light fresh herb like a parsley or chervil or something like that. So again, every sort of ingredient has its lifespan of, you know, being at its peak flavor. And then again, this when we're talking about salt, when I'm making a stew, I'll use a sort of a rich, heavy sea salt that I think is going to last for, you know, a good hour or so in the cooking process, and then add a little more and then add a little more. So again, you really want to think about what's going to happen with that ingredient and how long it's going to be at its peak to really bring out the best of the dish.
Is it important for somebody to really study all this, to be able to cook at home, to make great food? If we could give them a few real basic tips where they don't have to be students of, you know, culinary arts, but can do something right now to enhance what they're cooking at home, what would be like your top three or four tips?
Well, I think every opportunity to add flavor is a wonderful experience. And I think that traditionally, you know, if you follow, just as taking a very common example, if you follow the directions in the back of a box of rice, it'll say, okay, you know, this much water, this much rice, boil, serve. Well, you want to think about every recipe that you encounter. And is there an opportunity to add more flavor to that basic process of making rice than just by adding water? Well, what if you substitute another liquid for water that actually has more flavor, whether it's a chicken stock or something else that will go with the other flavors in the dish that you're going to be serving that rice with? You know, really look at every step of the process. You know, can you, if you're going to prepare a piece of meat, can you add flavor to it in advance? Can you brine that pork? Can you marinate that piece of meat? And then, you know, the process of, you know, during cooking, there's other opportunities to add flavor. And certainly afterwards, what kind of sauce or jus or what have you are you going to serve to accompany that? So there's many opportunities. And I think if people just think about them, they'll be able to do a better job of adding flavor.
And I think really one of the most important things you could do is walk into your kitchen and throw out your spice rack because likely those spices are very old. Spices typically last at their peak 6 months at best.
Wow.
And I actually make a point of throwing my spices out every January and July if I haven't turned them over. I mean, a lot of them I do turn over a lot, but that's one place you're going to notice immediate difference. I remember we came back from a trip to Spain, and I was replicating a dish we'd had in Spain, and I'm like, gosh, it's just not tasting the same. And I literally doubled the amount of the paprika and the smoked paprika to sort of replicate these wonderful fresh paprikas that they had there that I didn't have in the U.S. So, again, my spices were just old. So, again, I think that's something any kitchen will benefit from.
Let's talk about a couple of rule of thumbs here, because we've talked a little bit about pairing foods together so that they don't overwhelm each. One food doesn't overwhelm the other. But then you've also talked about contrasting. So how do you decide when food should be similar and when they should be dissimilar?
You know, that's a topic that we thought a lot about. Again, how our experience with wine pairing and food pairing has informed us in terms of how we think about food differently. And we've got this wonderful chart in the book, What to Drink with What You Eat, that really kind of sums that up, because it's so crucial, and especially for Valentine's Day weekend, of course, everybody's going to be thinking, well, what kind of wine do I serve? And that's when we start getting the questions from our readers saying things like, you know, I'm serving salmon, or I'm serving a, you know, wonderful rare steak that's nice and pink in the inside. You know, what do I serve with that? And if you're serving, you know, the key thing is if you're serving something that's salty, you always want a contrast. And certainly there aren't a lot of salty beverages so that to make it a comparison situation. But saltiness contrasts beautifully with bubbles, which makes champagne perfect for a Valentine's Day starter. If you're going to have, you know, a few dabs of caviar on blini, or, you know, some wonderful smoked salmon, champagne makes a wonderful accompaniment for that reason. When you're pairing with sour foods, you can you typically want to compare. When you've got some acidity in a dish, you want to make sure there's just as much acidity in your wine, if not more, in order for it to be able to stand up to the dish. And then bitter foods, you can go either way. You can either compare, serve, you know, if you've got a grilled steak and that grill will add a bit of bitterness to the steak, you can serve a tannic Cabernet where the bitterness in the wine will play off the bitterness in the grilled steak, and that can be as appealing, or you could use a comparison. If you've got that same grilled steak, you want to give some relief to the palate through a nice fruity red, that's a great way to do it.
And sweet foods, dessert. If you're having dessert and you serve a dessert wine, should the dessert wine be as sweet as the dessert, or sweeter than the dessert, or less sweet than the dessert?
You want to go with number two there. You want the wine to be sweeter than the dessert. Otherwise, it'll get blown out. And I think that's one of the problems with when you go to a wedding and you have that nice, beautiful piece of wedding cake at the end, and they serve it with a glass of champagne. Mm-hmm. It's not an ideal pairing, because it just sort of makes the champagne sort of flat and acidic and almost a little bitter. But if you have a sweet champagne that's sweeter than the cake, it's a really magical pairing. So you always want to have the wine sweeter than the dessert.
What about some of the really rich, fortified wines like port and those? What are they best served with?
Well, those sweet wines like port, you know, boy, we've fallen in love with them. We've gotten on a pet topic of ours. You know, and I think they pair so beautifully, not just with chocolate. I mean, I think, you know, who doesn't love chocolate? Well, when I first tasted chocolate with port, like a nice Oloroso or a beautiful PX sherry, I'm Crossing Borders. There we go. because I love them all. You know, I think of them as the Holy Trinity, so they're all trying to come out of my mouth at once. Tawny Port or Vintage Port with chocolate, Oloroso or PX Sherry with chocolate, and Banyuls, which is the French red sweet dessert wine from France. Those we call the Holy Trinity with chocolate because they will elevate chocolate to a whole other level. And I beg you, if you are a chocolate fan and you have never had the experience of trying chocolate with one of those three wines, run, don't walk, to your closest wine store and get some for this Valentine's Day weekend because it is an amazing experience.
Okay.
And I think for other times that you're given your location, if you have a pecan pie, grab a tawny port also. It's really one of the great, great pairings I've had this year.
And cheese. I mean, I love it with blue cheese and port. Fantastic.
And that's a whole different taste combination with when you're going cheese and port versus chocolate and port. And yet they both work.
Yeah, so after dinner, just pull out the port, go through the cheese course, and then take it into dinner with you.
I want to go to the phones, but one thing we haven't talked about is temperature, and that's one of the ingredients that you talk about in the Flavor Bible, temperature. And, for instance, I think you were talking earlier in the show about matching apples and cheddar cheese. I don't particularly care for that, but I like apple pie, but I don't like it hot. I like it at room temperature. Is that odd, or...?
Well, you just proved our point. Thank you so much for that example. I mean, you've proven that cold apple pie tastes different from hot apple pie.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a place for both, but I certainly understand that rationale. So it proves that there is a flavor. The same pie served at two different temperatures. One's going to make you happy, one isn't.
Yeah, and there's a chef in the book that is talking about ice cream and how he lets the ice cream warm up a little bit before he serves it because it tastes better.
Absolutely. And again, another way to look at that is to think about a glass of white wine. If a white wine is too cold, you'll get that, you know, it might taste a little flat, not that exciting. And 5 minutes later, it sort of warms up and you get the aroma and you get more flavors that come out of it. So if something is too cold, even ice cream, it's going to dull the flavors.
Well, I think, you know, Mike's example of the apple pie is great because I can't eat hot apple pie unless I have cold ice cream with it. But I would rather have a piece of cheese if I have cold apple pie. And I think I'm just realizing it now as we're speaking that it has to do with the way these two play off each other.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right. Let's take a couple of phone calls here before we completely run out of time. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE. Tom in Asheville, welcome. You're on the show.
Thank you for taking my call. Listening to your store here, I want to stop off at some restaurant and get a bite to eat.
Really?
all of the herbs and spices and the flavors out there that creates a dish that just has the depth and the essence. One dish that comes to my mind is a cassoulet. And my question to you folks is there any one dish that comes to your mind that describes the essence of what your book is about?
I hope to God there isn't, because I think what the Flavor Bible is all about is that there are an infinite number of dishes that you can make with the book, because you can take any ingredient in any one of an infinite number of directions and create something that's absolutely delicious and different from what you created yesterday and the day before that and the day before that. So I would say absolutely not. What I'm picturing is just a blank, a plain white plate that's empty, that is a canvas for any home culinary artists to just open up the refrigerator or open up their cupboards and see what's in there and to use it as an opportunity for creativity and joy to bring together something delicious.
Now, Tom, I have a note on my screen from the producer who says you have an example. Is that true?
Yes, cassoulet.
Cassoulet, you say?
Yes.
For the benefit of those who don't know what that is, why don't you tell us what it is and what it is about it that makes it so special for you?
Well, it is a long process, and so you have to attend to it. But it's the herbs, the duck, the pork, the seasonings in it, and just it takes it a long time for all those flavors to come about. But what it creates is greater. The whole is greater than its part. That's what comes to my mind.
Okay.
And that's exactly the definition of flavor synergy. Yeah. You know, one plus one doesn't equal two. One plus one equals three. And that happens when you're pairing lamb and rosemary or tomatoes and basil or apples and cinnamon, that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That's the definition of great cooking. Thank you so much for that example.
And a cassoulet certainly is a classic example in French cuisine of that blending of flavors through long, slow cooking. Mm. To create something that you could not achieve by any one ingredient by itself.
Tom, thank you for your call. Let me go to Morganton. John, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Good morning. I hope everybody's doing well.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy chocolate cake with buttermilk, the pairing of the food. My father, when he was growing up and they milking their own cows, he started that, and then I tried it once, and I could almost eat it till I get sick. The two together just are excellent. And since you can't get homemade buttermilk anymore, or it's very rare, I let the buttermilk go out of date recently, as much as 2 weeks when I finished up my last gallon.
Wow. Now, what does that having? I think I had buttermilk once when I was a child and spit it across the room.
You just haven't had it with chocolate cake, Mike. Well, we got to get you back on the wagon.
Well, that's what I want to know. What do the two flavors do for each other, John?
They complement. It is. I have, for years, when I was in the military and overseas in different countries, they would say, try this wine with this meat or this food with this drink. And I never could understand it because they needed to be by themselves to taste good, in my opinion. But when I tried the buttermilk, I don't know if you think about the milk with cottage cheese in it. It's kind of clumpy. It's almost gross.
Mm-hmm.
But the two, and my parents still cook bread and different things with buttermilk. But the pairing of the two is just excellent.
Okay.
Probably a little bit of that sweet and sour going there that, again, enhances and magnifies each of the flavor ranges.
Thanks for the tip.
And actually, my favorite chocolate cake recipe calls for buttermilk is one of the ingredients. So there's a synergy there.
Okay. Thanks for your call, John. Let me go to Moravian Falls. Brent, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Good morning, folks. I just wanted to comment, I'm constantly doing what you're talking about. I'm a leftovers kind of guy, but I had, like last night, I had a bunch of stuffing-sized mushrooms. I had to use them up and slice them up, saute them in some butter and some cheap burgundy. And when that got done, I had about 3 ounces of chorizo I had to use up. And I took them out of the pan, put the chorizo in, and I never overcook my chorizo. I like to leave it just a little bit greasy. And I put the mushrooms back in there, did some corn tortillas, and a little bit of sour cream, and it was amazing.
Wow.
I had to pat myself on the back.
we have a chef in our midst here.
It sounds like you've really worked with those flavors in a way that, you know, again, the enhancement of flavors.
We didn't talk about poaching versus frying and braising and grilling and how that might play a role in combining flavors. And we didn't talk about why certain things just seem appropriate for certain seasons, like cinnamon and nutmeg seem wintry to me as opposed to citrus, which seems summery. But you can find more about that in the Flavor Bible. Karen Page and Andrew Dornenbuch's great book. They're food writers and James Beard award-winning co-authors. And they joined us today from studios at Carnegie Hall. Thank you both for being here. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
And Peter Reinhardt, chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University. Always a pleasure. See you soon.
I am hungry now.
Okay, here's Hank.
Hey, good looking, what you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
Charlotte Thompson.